Hello, I'm Ian, a news presenter on the Black Country Talking News, and this week's edition of the Talking News is for Wednesday, the 24th of February, 2021.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by Sightlust charity, Beacon Centre. A message to our listeners who receive the Talking News on CD in the post: this remains in paper envelopes and not the usual plastic wallets, so there's still no need to send anything back to us. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. All you need to do is say, "Alexa, play Black Country Talking News." Our Talking News service is also available via the following methods: calling 01902 213 210, visiting our website www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast on the Black Country Radio website www.blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts, on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by simply searching Beacon Black Country Talking News and hitting the subscribe button, and on your mobile or tablet device by downloading the free British Wireless for the Blind Talking News application from your App Store. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Thank you, Simon. And in this week, we have myself, Rob, writer Graham Fisher, Mina, Ed, Sharon, Helen, Simon, Liz, Christine, Ian, Angela, and of course, Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have an update from Beacon, some local news from the Black Country. We have the Flashback Quiz with Mina, news from West Bromwich Albion and Wolves, a Did You Know section from Flashback Roger, a look back at decimalisation, the weather, another edition of Sounds of Nature, information about diabetic retinopathy, a football poem, and rounding all that off, an edition of Tales from the Barn with Graham Fisher. But we start with some local news, brought to us by Angela, Ian and Christine.
New government headquarters will be set up in the Black Country as part of plans to move more civil servant roles out of London. The Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government will have a new home in Wolverhampton, with 500 posts, including senior civil servants, moving to the West Midlands by 2025. It will be the first ever ministerial office outside of Westminster and is part of the Places for Growth programme, which aims to shift away from the London-centric approach to government. The department will keep its London office, but have dual headquarters there and in Wolverhampton, in a move which Communities Secretary Robert Jenrick said would see a regular ministerial presence in the city. A base for the department is expected to be announced in the coming weeks, with the new I-9 development near the railway station put forward as a potential site. Mr. Jenrick said the move was a historic step that would spread opportunity and prosperity across the region. He said, "With a dual headquarters in Wolverhampton, my department will not only change where we work, but how we work, signalling the end of the Whitehall knows best approach. All of us at the department are looking forward to having the opportunity to work there. This government knows that by having more local voices at the heart of our policy development and delivery, we will support our communities more effectively, and we will continue to develop greater career options in government outside of London. In choosing Wolverhampton, we're also backing our great smaller cities, some of which have been neglected for too long. We want to raise their stature, encourage civic pride and commercial success."
More than 300 fines have been handed out across the West Midlands in 1 week to people breaching COVID-19 restrictions. A total of 317 fixed penalty notices were issued to people flouting the rules by police between February the 8th and February the 14th, and a total of 1,568 people were given directions to leave in total, where people are fined, arrested or ordered to disperse. Around 70 of the fines were given out at one illegal rave in Birmingham, where police were pelted with bottles as they arrived to break up the gathering. On the same night, officers discovered a garage in the Black Country which had been turned into the COVID Arms pub. Police and Crime Commissioner David Jamieson said, Most of the events police were called to were house parties, where people were celebrating birthdays, weddings or whatever, and they are meeting in large numbers in breach of the COVID regulations. On the weekend, on Friday and Saturday night, there were 121 breaches logged by the police, which occasioned another 117 of the £200 fines and 9 of the £800 fines.
New Nightingale courts are set to open in the West Midlands as part of plans to tackle a crippling backlog of cases. Two additional hearing spaces for Crown Court cases will open in Wolverhampton, and three hearing rooms will open in Maple House, Corporation Street, Birmingham, the government has announced. A venue is expected to be confirmed for the Wolverhampton site in the coming days. In total, 14 new temporary courts will open in an effort to clear a backlog of around 56,000 cases, the majority of which have built up during the coronavirus pandemic. 23 Nightingale courts are already up and running across the country, including one at Shire Hall in Stafford, which deals with civil and family court cases. Among the new sites will be a super courtroom at Manchester Crown Court to deal with cases involving multiple defendants being tried together, such as gang murder trials. Courts will also be set up at the Barbican in London and Manchester's Hilton Hotel, as well as sites in Liverpool, Croydon and Chichester. The Lord Chancellor, Robert Buckland, said the courts will help reduce delays and deliver justice for victims. We have achieved an immense amount in our battle to keep justice moving during the pandemic, restarting jury trials before anyone else, turbocharging the rollout of video technology, bringing magistrates' backlogs down, and opening more courtrooms for jury trials, he said. These new courts are the latest step in that effort, and I am determined to minimise delays and ensure justice is served for victims, defendants and the public.
People are being reminded they should only be going shopping for essentials. After it emerged, nearly 100,000 people visited a Black Country shopping centre in 1 week. The figures were for visitors heading to Hales Owen's Cornbow shopping centre last week. Bosses are worried figures will be even higher this week while children are off for the February half term. The figure for visitors at the Cornbow Centre only peaked at around 60,000 during the first lockdown. Under current lockdown rules, people should stay at home unless shopping for necessities or to exercise, or if they have to leave home to go to work. If people do have to leave home, they should stay in their local area unless it is necessary to travel further for work. Karen Wright, Director of Public Health at Dudley Council, said, "The figures for the Cornbow are very concerning. We need to remind people that they should be staying at home unless it is absolutely necessary. This minimises social contact and reduces chances of us spreading the virus. We all have a part to play in that, and I would urge people to think twice and consider whether trips are essential before leaving their homes. That applies to the whole borough and all our town centres, of course, not just Hales Owen."
People living near a Black Country pub have been enjoying a vivid tribute to a hero of the pandemic. A mural in memory of Captain Sir Tom Moore has been painted across the back wall of the Little Beach pub in Blackheath, showing his name in red and a full drawing of the fundraiser and army veteran. The mural appeared on the wall at the pub on Hales Owen Street following Sir Tom's death on February the 2nd, and people from all over the town have since come to lay flowers and pay their respects. One local woman who did not want to be named said she had been told about the mural by her son and had wanted to go down and see it. She said, "I've been staying at home because of COVID, but I went up to see it the Sunday after Captain Tom had died, and I put some flowers down. I couldn't believe how many flowers there were, as my son had told me there were tributes there, but it's more than I imagined, and there are flowers from across the world." She also said that she didn't know who had done the mural, but wanted to thank them for such a beautiful tribute. She said, "It's really good, and I think it really shows up the people saying things about him online. I think it was wonderful what he did, and it was a journey for him, as to do it one day is good, but to keep going for 100 days is incredible. I don't know the person that did this, but they are clearly very talented, and I think it's a fitting tribute to a lovely man.
Three more local news bulletins coming up, but now it's time for our weekly update from Beacon.
Hi everyone, it's Helen from the Beacon Centre. We're heading into the last week of February already. How did that happen? I think we're all hoping for brighter days in March, but if you're struggling with sight loss or the impact of COVID-19 restrictions, here's four ways you can get support from Beacon right now. 1. Befriending calls. We're all struggling with the latest lockdown. If you feel like you benefit from someone to talk to, then why not sign up to our telephone befriending service and enjoy a regular catch-up with someone who has similar interests to you. 2. Employment support. We've got a range of employment programs that could help you look for work or just improve your skills. Our Building Better Opportunities Evolve and Bridges programs are funded by the European Social Fund and the National Lottery Community Fund. 3. Sight loss support. Whether you're newly diagnosed or you've been struggling with sight loss issues for some time, our amazing team of sight loss advisors can make sure you get the support you need. 4. Virtual activities. Each week, we've got a range of virtual activities with something for everyone to get involved in. Sessions are free and all are welcome. You can find out more details on our social media. Just search for Beacon Centre on Facebook, or to find out more by telephone, call 01902 880 111 Monday to Fridays, and you can find out about any of the ways we can support you on that number. As usual, it's been a busy few weeks at Beacon. We've just wrapped up on our Five a Fortnight campaign to encourage everyone living locally to donate £5 to help support our services. If you donated, thank you. We've never needed your support more, so it's so appreciated. And if you didn't get the chance to donate, but you'd like to show your support, well, you can donate £5 by texting Beacon Fiver, that's all one word, Beacon Fiver, to 70085. Texts cost £5 plus one standard rate message. Thank you. Now, it was recently Love Your Pet Day. We're all animal lovers here at Beacon, and we know that many of you are as well. To mark the day, we asked some of the Beacon team to tell us why their pet means so much to them. Our sight loss advisor Sharon has a guide dog called Jeannie. She said that Jeannie's made a big difference for her during the pandemic. She told us, "Jeannie has kept me to a routine over the COVID-19 restrictions, safe, happy, and has kept me mobile, as she's my guide." For our executive support manager, Victoria, it was all about the unconditional love her two cats, Bazza and Reg, along with dog Opie, give her and her partner. And for our engagement manager, Becky, her pet does so much for her. She said, "My sausage dog, Rupert, has helped me during the pandemic by accompanying me on long countryside walks in the fresh air, keeping me company during the day while working from home, and giving the best cuddles just when you need one." You can't beat a cuddle with your pet. We would love to hear the difference that your pet makes for you. You can email us at bctn@beaconvision.org. If you're a fan of Coronation Street, you'll know that character Johnny Connor has just been diagnosed with Charles Bonnet syndrome. It's a sight loss condition that can cause really disturbing hallucinations. And if you'd like to find out more about it, you can call us on 01902 880 111 Mondays to Fridays. Lastly, this week, we so appreciate all your donations to our stores. They help us support people like you with sight loss when they need us the most. But while our shops are closed, though, please keep hold of any items you'd like to donate, as leaving them outside our stores can cause a hazard. When it's safe to do so, we can't wait to welcome you back. And in the meantime, don't forget you can shop online at our eBay store, www.ebay.co.uk/USR/Beacon Charity Shop. That's www.ebay.co.uk/USR/Beacon Charity Shop. That's it for this week. Hopefully, I'll speak to you all again soon.
Thanks, Helen. We now head back to the local news. Reading for us, we have Ed, Christine, Angela, and at the top of the bill, it's Ian.
A village police station has gone up for sale as part of cost-cutting plans by West Midlands Police. Sedgley Police Station will go under the hammer on March the 31st in a sale by Bond Wolf Auctions. The police station is one of more than 70 to close over the last decade as part of West Midlands Police's Estates Programme, which aims to save money by disposing underused buildings. The sale, however, has been branded diabolical by Sedgley Ward Councillor Michael Evans, who believes the station on Vicar Street should be kept in the community. Councillor Evans said, "It is a big mistake selling the police station. The quality of policing has gone right down since it was closed to the public. I am completely against the closure of the police station. It is diabolical. It is a place where people can phone and get in touch with officers in the area. It is taking away the right for people to feel safe." Officers based at Sedgley Police Station moved from the premises in October. However, the front desk had closed before that period. Those staff members were relocated to Dudley Fire Station as part of the Estates Programme. David Jameson, the West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner, said in October, "Co-locating with our colleagues in West Midlands Fire Service has allowed neighbourhood teams to remain where the public want them to be, at the heart of the communities which they serve. Not only will this move allow us to save money, but it will also mean that officers are able to work much closer with the fire service."
Facebook has apologised after a Black Country groups page was threatened with closure after members discussed the classic local delicacy faggots and peas. Members of the Pensnet, Briley Hill and Black Country Now and Then History group posted the word faggots with reference to the region's traditional meal. However, bots from Facebook said use of the derogatory word had violated its community standards, with the social media company later admitting it had made a mistake. Marilyn MacDonald, a member of the group, said, "We discuss local news. We discuss memories, pictures, and our food too, and local Black Country dishes. We came onto the subject of faggots and peas, and Facebook have gone ballistic and have got rid of one of the admins of the group. They say faggots is a derogatory word, but it's our dialect, for goodness sake. Something needs to be done because we don't use it in a derogatory way. I can't say how anybody could be offended by the word when referring to the dish. I just find it ridiculous. I find it disgusting that they can abuse our heritage like this." A spokesperson for Facebook said, "Our systems clearly made a mistake here, and we apologise to users whose posts about this local delicacy were affected. We're looking into what happened, and we are taking steps to rectify the error."
A Black Country council is on track to boost its affordable housing stock despite pressures of building new homes during the COVID-19 pandemic. For the past 10 years, Dudley Council chiefs have been determined to build hundreds of new council homes as part of the authority's new Build Council Homes project. The council has worked with local developers to provide affordable and quality homes for the residents of Dudley on pockets of council land, such as disused garage sites that were identified as ripe for development. Since the start of the pandemic, the council has been able to ensure developments can go ahead by following COVID secure guidelines. In the last 12 months alone, it has meant more than 40 homes have been completed, including 6 homes on land on Redfly Lane in Pensnet, 8 on Portway Close in Kings Winford, 3 on Kinfair Rise in Upper Gornal, 10 on Muster Road in Netherton, and 14 on Stewart's Road in Hells Owen. Another 30 homes are also being built, including 10 on the Broadway in Norton and 12 on Hinbrook Road in Dudley. Councillor Laura Taylor, Cabinet Member for Housing and Community Services, said, "The last 12 months have certainly thrown up a few challenges for our housing developments, but I'm delighted we've been able to follow COVID-safe practices and remain on track to fulfil our commitment to providing more affordable housing across the borough."
A popular city centre sports bar is undergoing a revamp which will create new jobs when lockdown ends. Hayden Dando from Penkridge and Graham Jones from Cheslin Hay have taken over Riley Sports Bar on Broad Street in Wolverhampton. Hayden said, "We will be undergoing a rebrand of the venue and it will be known as Centre Spot Sports Bar. We will be keeping pool, snooker and darts, as well as having a big emphasis on live sport. We are also looking at a DJ on a Friday and Saturday night, and we are aiming to turn the venue into a really fun, exciting place to visit, as well as being an affordable venue, as we know how tight things will be for many people following the pandemic. Hayden, 35, runs Lionheart Security Services in Wolverhampton, as well as being the joint owner of Hensford Town Football Club and former owner of V-Bar in Briley Hill. Graham, 42, is also the joint owner of Hensford Football Club, as well as running Residential and Commercial Engineering Limited in Cannock. Hayden added, "We want to give people something to look forward to once this is all over. It has also created 10 new jobs immediately, with further jobs to be created once the pandemic is over."
Tributes have been paid to a much-loved councillor and former mayor of Dudley who has lost her fight against COVID-19. Margaret Wilson served as a councillor on Dudley Council for 24 years and was mayor of the borough between 2002 to 2003. She died on February the 4th, aged 89, at Comberton Nursing Home in Stourbridge after testing positive for the virus on January 31st. Now her family, as well as councillors, have paid tribute to the lovely, popular lady who was proud to serve her community. Sally Lucas, one of Margaret's granddaughters, said, "She worked for the council for many years and she was never a complainer. That's what was fabulous about Nan. Even when she was in the nursing home, she never complained and she was always smiling and had a lot to talk about. She was very close with her daughter and they would talk for many hours on the phone. Nan put everyone first, even when she worked for the council. Even the smallest things she would help people with. Being a councillor was her passion. She held surgeries in Briley Hill and anyone could turn up. Even if they had the smallest problem, she would always try to help them out." Margaret had one daughter, Rona Lucas, four grandchildren, Kelly, Emma, Sally and Nikki, and four great-grandchildren. She had served as a councillor on Dudley Council for 24 years, representing people in Briley Hill. She became the mayor of the borough between 2002 to 2003.
We have two more news updates coming up, but now it's time to cross over to Mina.
Hello and welcome to the Flashback Quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers' Did You Know feature. But for now, here are your questions. Are you ready? Question 1. How long was the longest tiramisu that was made in Italy? Question 2. How many took to the saddle to ride the longest bicycle? Question 3. How many times would you have to fold a piece of paper so it would be thick enough to reach the moon? Question 4. In what year was Oxford University founded? Question 5. What makes stars appear to twinkle? And question 6. How heavy is an average cloud? As always, I'll be back to reveal the answers later in the show, but for now, good luck!
Thanks for those questions, Mina. Now we have some more local news, brought to us by Ed, Ian, Christine and Angela.
A world-class entertainment venue operator is set to be appointed to run the long-delayed civic halls, council chiefs have announced. The Wolverhampton City Centre venue is due to reopen in early 2022 following a major refurbishment programme which has gone over budget and way past its original completion date of 2017. Council chiefs say once open, the venue will again host leading musical and entertainment acts, attracting visitors to the city and boosting the local economy. The refurbishment was originally supposed to cost £10.4 million and be completed by 2017, expanding capacity to around 5,000 and bringing vastly improved facilities. The famous venue has now been largely out of action for around 5 years, but the final price tag for the works is expected to be beyond £43 million. Wolverhampton's council was due to approve a preferred operator from a short list of premier names at a meeting this week. The preferred operator, which will then enter into a long-term partnership with the authority, will be announced in May. The new operator will also work closely with development contractor Wilmot Dixon Interiors on the final stages of the multi-million pound transformation of the Grade 2 listed building. Councillor Stephen Simpkins, Cabinet Member for City Economy, said bold and ambitious projects like the Civic Halls, the award-winning interchange, I-9, Art Gallery, future High Streets Fund improvements and Canalside City Living Plans are essential to the Wolverhampton's regeneration strategy, wider transformation and economic well-being. They were important before COVID-19 struck, and they're even more important now.
A major milestone has been reached in Dudley's Very Light Rail, VLR, programme, with the completion of the test track. The new test track is vital in making the borough a focus in rail innovation and runs from the bottom of Castle Hill to Cinderbank Island. The test track is where a Coventry VLR prototype vehicle, which is being developed by Coventry City Council and WMG, will be tested later this year. Councillor Patrick Harley, leader of Dudley Council, toured the site this week with Andy Street, the West Midlands Mayor, to see the progress firsthand. The senior figures also got to see the work in progress on site, including the National Innovation Centre. Councillor Harley said, "This project continues to move forward at pace, despite the national restrictions, which is excellent news. The new test track is a significant part of this development and one step closer to making Dudley a global leader in rail innovation." In August last year, the West Midlands Combined Authority, WMCA, supported a £13 million bid to bridge a funding shortfall in the scheme. The authority has also supported the VLR scheme as part of its wider vision for the West Midlands. Mr. Street said, "This project puts the West Midlands on the cutting edge of transport innovation and development and shows how collaborative working is delivering for our region."
A councillor is celebrating after CCTV cameras and extra signs were installed to help tackle fly tipping. Councillor Paul Appleby, who represents Bushbury North, Wolverhampton, has been working with the council to protect Moseley Road. It comes after the area saw an increase in fly tipping in recent months, with councillors determined to tackle the issue. Councillor Appleby has also been working with South Staffordshire District Council due to it being on the border of the areas. He said, "I'm delighted to have secured new CCTV for Moseley Road to tackle the ongoing problem. Fly tipping is not a victimless crime. Landowners are often blocked from accessing their land and the taxpayers left with paying cleanup costs. I am hopeful that the addition of CCTV and extra signage will help catch those perpetrating this crime. At the very least, I'd like for this action to deter people from fly tipping."
Work is due to start this month on a major new £30 million development at the Black Country Living Museum. Bosses at the Dudley attraction have given the green light to the Forging Ahead project, which will see 22 new historic buildings added to the site, including the brick-by-brick relocation of Holly Hall's Woodside Library. The expansion, the biggest since the museum opened in 1978, will focus on the period from the 1940s to the 1960s and will feature an NHS clinic, a barber's and a co-op supermarket. The old Stanton's Music Shop from Castle Street, Dudley, will be reborn, and there will also be a recreation of the Elephant and Castle pub, which once dominated the corner of Stafford Street and Cannock Road in Wolverhampton. A new industrial quarter will sit alongside the new town, while a new visitor centre will also be built. Work had been due to start last year, but was delayed due to the pandemic. The site is currently home to a vaccination centre. Councillor Patrick Harley, leader of Dudley Council, said, "This is fantastic news and a really exciting new development for what is already a top-class visitor attraction. It's been well documented that the pandemic and lockdowns have hit our tourist attractions hard, but it's great to see one of the biggest outlining plans to come out the other side bigger and better, with plans to welcome even more visitors to the borough in the future."
Tributes have been paid to a much-loved Wolves club steward following his death from COVID-19. Paul Nightingale fought a seven-week battle with the virus before the 58-year-old from Lunt died in mid-January at New Cross Hospital. His death has led to an outpouring of tributes from the club, as well as colleagues and supporters who knew Mr. Nightingale from his time working in the Stan Cullis stand at Molyneux. Mr Nightingale's smiling face was shown on the big screen at the stadium before the match against Leeds last Friday, the day of his funeral. It followed a tribute in the matchday programme for the game against Leicester earlier this month. Fellow steward Dave Parsons paid tribute by putting Mr Nightingale's steward's coat on one of the seats in the stand called his stand. Mr Parsons described his former boss as a really down-to-earth and nice man who would be sorely missed. He was my supervisor and friend for 20 years and was one absolutely fantastic chap, he said. He would always have a laugh with all the people in the stand, nicking sweets off them and speaking to everyone, and he would do anything for the disabled people, getting them hot drinks and things like that. The tribute in the Wolves Matchday programme said, "Sadly, the Wolves family had to say goodbye to one of our own this week. After a 7-week battle with COVID-19, long-serving steward Paul Nightingale passed away at the untimely age of 58. Paul worked in the Stand Cullis stand on match days and started as a steward at Wolves in 1989, working for the club for just over 31 years.
Coming up next, we have Beacon Voices. This week we hear from Sharon, who tells us about diabetic retinopathy.
Hello, my name is Sharon and I'm a sight loss advisor for Beacon, the local sight loss charity. Today I'm going to talk about what is diabetic retinopathy. Diabetic retinopathy is a common complication of diabetes caused by high blood sugar levels, which damage the back of the eye. If undiagnosed and untreated, can cause blindness. It usually takes several years to develop. It is crucial to control your blood sugar levels, blood pressure, and cholesterol. You must attend your annual diabetic eye screening. The retina is the light-sensitive layer of cells at the back of the eye that converts light into electrical signals. The signals send to the brain, which turns them into images you see. The retina needs a constant supply of blood, which it receives through a network of tiny blood vessels. Over time, persistent high blood sugar levels damage these blood vessels in the three main stages. Here are the three main stages of retinopathy. Background retinopathy, tiny bulges develop in the blocked blood vessels, which may bleed slightly, but don't usually affect your vision. Pre-proliferative retinopathy, more severe and widespread changes affect the blood vessels, including more sufficient bleeding into the eye. You will see dark blobs or thread-like lines in the eye. This is blood seeping from the blood vessels into the eye. Proliferative retinopathy is scar tissue and new blood vessels grow, which are weak and bleed easily, develop on the retina. This can result in some vision loss. You are at greater risk if you have had diabetes for a long period of time, have persistently high blood sugar levels, have high blood pressure and high cholesterol levels. If you are pregnant and are of Asian or Afro-Caribbean background, you won't usually notice diabetes retinopathy in the early stages, as it does not have any symptoms until it is more advanced. However, photographs taken of the back of the eye at your annual screening can detect any abnormalities. If you're experiencing a general loss of vision or sudden vision loss, shapes floating in your field of vision, they're called floaters, blurred or patchy vision, eye pain or redness, it is important to get them checked. Don't wait until the next eye screening appointment. Visit your optician or call the emergency eye clinic. These are usually situated in A&E. So what are the main treatments for diabetic retinopathy? Laser treatment to cauterize the weak veins. You will be given an eye anesthetic before a laser light will be shined into your eyes and eye drops that enlarge the pupil. The treatment takes around 20 to 40 minutes and is carried out at an outpatient appointment. You may require more than one visit. It isn't usually painful, just a sharp tickling sensation when certain areas are being treated. After the treatment, you might experience some blurred vision. Do not drive. An increased sensation to light. Wear sunglasses or block glasses. An aching or slight discomfort or a headache. You can take paracetamol for that. Injections of medication into the eye to treat severe maculopathy, which threatens your sight. This is done at an outpatient appointment. An operation to remove blood or scar tissue from your eyes. This is called a vitreous humor. The transparent jelly substance that fills the space between the lens is replaced by oil or a gas bubble. These are usually carried out under local anesthetic or sedation. You can go home after, but will need to wear a patch for a few days and may be prescribed antibiotic drops to stop you getting an infection. Remember, keep control of your diabetes by eating the right foods in the right amounts. Speak to your diabetes care team for support and information. Keep control of your blood pressure. Take your medications. Visit the practice nurse or doctor to get your blood pressure tested. Keep cholesterol levels below 5. Keep attending your diabetic eye screening and your reviews. If you would like any further information, contact the Beacon Centre on 01902 880 111. Thank you.
Thanks, Sharon. Coming up next, we have more local news, brought to us by Angela, Christine, Ed, and starting us off, it's Ian.
Wolves captain Connor Cody has been packing food parcels to distribute to local families in a bid to reduce food poverty. Wolves Foundation has launched the Feed Our Pack campaign, and Cody, who is a foundation ambassador, helped pack more than 250 parcels. He said this goes to show how important this football club is in the city and how important the city is to the football club. We are lucky to get to play football during the pandemic when other people can't go to work and can't do things that they want to do. We understand the privileges that we have got. So if there is anything that we can do to give back, like with Wolves Foundation and this project, then we will always do our best to help. Many supporters have already contributed to the 500,000 Feed Our Pack Fund that was launched thanks to £250,000 grant from the Premier League and PFA Community Fund, which was match funded by Wolves head coach Nuno Espirito Santo.
Comedy duo Dick and Dom visited Wyre Forest to film scenes for an upcoming episode of The Gadget Show. The CBBC stars spent Monday afternoon with a camera crew and Gadget Show presenter John Bentley filming scenes for the Channel 5 show at Bodenham Arboretum near Wolverley. Richard McCourt and Dominic Wood, better known as Dick and Dom, spent the afternoon filming in and around the Arboretum for an episode of the show, expected to be broadcast next month. During their visit, Dick, Dom and John met Bodenham Arboretum's newest arrival, a baby donkey named Diego, born at the end of November, as well as a border collie, Elvis. James Binion, owner and manager of Bodenham Arboretum, said, "We were delighted to be asked permission by the Gadget Show to film here. Everyone obviously had to maintain social distancing, but Dick, Dom and John were charming guests and they brought much laughter to a dull winter's afternoon. We believe the footage will be featured on the Gadget Show on Friday the 26th of March on Channel 5 at 7 p.m. and look forward to seeing a local landmark being part of a nationwide broadcast." Bodenham Arboretum announced the visit on their Facebook page, adding, "We had some VIPs visit today. Dick and Dom were in the Arboretum. We were delighted to accommodate the gadget show and presenter John Bentley, who had invited the intrepid CBBC stars to be guest presenters for an episode. Elvis, of course, took on a role of runner, literally, whilst ensuring that everyone adhered to social distancing.
A roe deer had to be rescued after getting stuck in a metal fence surrounding a Black Country school. A walker found the animal in the precarious position with her bum stuck in the railings at Smestow School in Wolverhampton and alerted the RSPCA. Animal rescuers Cara Gibbon and Claire Davey were sent to the scene, and with the help of the school caretaker, they went to work to try to free the animal, who was half in and half out of the fence, but otherwise appeared uninjured. They put a blanket over the deer's head to stop her getting stressed, while they tried to bend the bars out using a car jack, but this didn't work. So they then used a saw on one of the railings to create some space, and while Claire removed the cover from the deer's head, Cara gently pushed the deer forward to make her escape following the incident on February the 9th. Cara said, "She was a beautiful roe deer, and it was a lovely feeling after releasing her to watch her happily run free. We believe she had been running in the area at night and thought she could get through the railings in the gates, but misjudged the gap and her bum was unable to get through. As she tried to go forward, she was unable to move as the metal had trapped her between her hips and her waist. Luckily, she was spotted and we were called to help. We tend to be called to help quite a lot of deer trapped in this way. Hopefully, she will learn from this encounter."
Sweet treats and snacks have been handed out to overstretched hospital staff by Dudley North MP Marco Longhi. Members of St Thomas's Muslim Community Forum decided to help lift morale of staff at Dudley's Russell Hall Hospital, many of whom have been helping patients battle COVID-19. Admissions to the wards and to the intensive care unit have been high, and the loss of patients dying from the virus has been a strain and heartbreaking for healthcare workers. Forum members distributed hot meals to staff last April and decided to reach out again to help lift the morale of surgeons, doctors and nurses by working alongside the MP to help organise another food drop. This time, the food parcels included sweet treats and snacks such as chocolates, biscuits, crisps and drinks. Abra Ahmed, on behalf of the group, said, "It's important the community continue to support our NHS staff." Marco Longhi MP remarked, "Today really has shown how deep the community spirit is in Dudley. NHS staff have been fighting to battle this disease under the most challenging circumstances, and I know everyone continues to appreciate their heroic efforts." He thanked the Muslim Community Forum for thinking of others at such a difficult time, and also Morrison's in Kings Winford for their assistance with the snacks provided. Diana Wake, Chief Executive of the Dudley Group NHS Foundation Trust, said, "This is such a kind gesture and the snacks will be very welcome in our intensive care unit and other wards where staff are working so hard to look after our patients."
Wild birds have been struggling to find food during the recent cold spell, and the general manager of a garden centre is appealing to people to consider them. Steve Hallett from the Hollybush Garden Centre at Shares Hill said, "It is important that at this time of the year, people consider our wildlife and particularly our smaller birds, such as blue tits, great tits, robins and the gold and green finches. During lockdowns, people have been enjoying their gardens and the outdoors, and many will have spent time watching the birds. It is only right that people consider the birds and the difficulties they face at this time. Our wild birds are struggling to find natural food at this time of the year, and particularly when temperatures have dropped below zero. It is important people put out food to help them survive and to help get them in peak condition for the breeding season. They need high energy foods such as sunflower hearts, fat balls, and peanuts. They need plenty of fats to help them survive. People should also put out water for the birds, either in bird baths or in shallow dishes."
Now we head to Roger, who has for us another edition of his Did You Know feature.
Hello Hi again, everybody. This is Rog with this week's results of my trawl through the wonderful world of strange and interesting and unexpected facts for you to enjoy, and where you'll find the answer to the quiz questions that were set earlier. Well, firstly this week, the longest tiramisu ever measured was 897 feet and 3 inches long. If you love tiramisu, as I do, then you'll probably think you could never get too much of the tasty treat. However, you might reconsider that opinion when you find out that the longest tiramisu ever created was 897 feet, 3 inches long. Enough for anybody. It was produced by Italian cheese brand Galbani, and students from the Milan Cooking School assembled the giant dessert, which was then divided up and served to those at the record-breaking event, while an additional 15,000 pieces went to local children's hospitals. Next, the longest bicycle in the world is over 135 feet long, and if you've ever ridden a tandem bike, you know that it can be tricky to get one moving. Crafted by Santos and the University of South Australia in 2015, a group of cyclists did manage to ride the bike, but unfortunately, it didn't say how many people took the saddle. Now then, if you could fold a piece of paper 42 times, it would be thick enough to reach the moon. What? Well, according to Gizmodo, all it takes to verify this is some simple maths. If you fold a piece of paper in half, it doubles in thickness. And if you fold it again in half, again, it doubles in thickness again. With that type of exponential growth, it would take just 23 folds for a 0.1 millimetre piece of paper to be 1 kilometre thick, and 30 folds for it to be thick enough to reach outer space, 100,000 kilometres. Unfortunately, the world record for folding paper is 12. In Oxford, the university is older than the Aztecs. Oxford University is older than the Aztecs, would you believe? The Aztec civilization of central Mexico began in 1325 with the founding of the city Tenochtitlan. That seems a long time ago to me, and it was. But if you ever look back even further to witness the founding of Oxford University, it started as a learning hub as early as 1096, and by 1249, the university had established itself as an educational institution. Now, here's a nice little jingle. His twinkle, twinkle, little star may have led us to believe that the massive celestial bodies in the night sky are sparkling, but it turns out that the flashing we see is merely a space mirage. The light that emanates from stars is steady and constant, but Earth's atmosphere interferes with what we witness, which is why they appear to twinkle. And lastly, the average cloud weighs an estimated 551 tons. Clouds may look like giant fluffy puffs of cotton, but they're actually quite hefty. Despite their immense weight, that heavy cloud is floating overhead because the air below is even heavier. The lesser density of the cloud allows it to float on the drier and more dense air. Truly fascinating, and truly funny to me anyway. Well, there you go, folks. I hope that you are truly amazed this week and that you'll be able to gather the answers to this week's quiz questions. But for now, I'll just say bye for now. Ta-ra!
Thanks, Roger. Now we head over to Mina with the weather forecast for the week ahead.
The weather for this week ahead will be much drier, giving the gardeners the perfect opportunity to get sowing for the first seeds of spring. Due to the time of year, low UV levels are expected all week. The sunrise and sunset times are 6:58 a.m. for the sunrise and 5:45 p.m. for the sunset. For Friday 26th of February through to Sunday 28th of February, we have sunny intervals and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 12 degrees. On Monday 1st of March to Wednesday 3rd of March, we have light cloud and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 13 degrees. And finally, on Thursday 4th of March, we have sunny intervals and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 11 degrees. So that's your forecast for the week. As always, enjoy the weather.
Cheers, Mina. Now, we once again pick up our ears as we listen again to some sounds of nature.
The robin is one of the most familiar birds of the UK, regularly visiting gardens. Robins are also common in parks, scrub and woodland, making their presence known with a loud, territorial song. They sing from prominent perches right through the winter, when both males and females hold territories. Indeed, they are fiercely territorial, driving off intruders and even fighting. During the breeding season, the female is allowed into the male's territory, where she sets up a nest of dead leaves, moss and hair. Nests often crop up in the oddest places, such as plant pots, old wellies and shells, but ivy and other shrubs are their natural choice. The robin really is unmistakable. This recording was made by Lawrence Shove and was made available by the British Library. Coming up next, we have Ian with the sport.
Hello, I'm Ian, and here's your latest football news. Albion played for more than an hour with 10 men, but still should have beaten Burnley following a pulsating clash at Turf Moor. The Baggies saw defender Semi Ajayi dismissed on the half-hour mark when, as the last man, he inadvertently handled the ball to deny a clear goal-scoring opportunity. After that, the hosts were expected to go on and win the game. Instead, Albion dominated the chances created and had three glorious opportunities to win it. First, the impressive Ainsley Maitland-Niles collected the ball in the box before working himself some space before firing over. Mbaye Diagne then tricked his way past James Tarkowski before powering a strike against the crossbar when it was easier to score. But while that was an incredible miss, what followed was even more remarkable. Diagne squared for Mateus Pereira to have a simple tap-in, but the ball hit the Brazilian's heel. Maitland-Niles kept the move alive and found Pereira again, who this time did get a shot away just yards from goal. But goalkeeper Nick Pope somehow got something on the ball, and that meant Tarkowski was able to head it clear from the goal line. In stark contrast, Burnley created next to nothing over the 90 minutes, with Sam Johnstone not having to make a save. But while Sam Allardyce will be proud of his team's overall display, he knows Albion need wins, and fast, with this a huge opportunity they let slip by. The Baggies next face Brighton at home this Saturday. Sam Allardyce says Albion will have a shot at securing Premier League survival if they keep 8 clean sheets in their remaining 13 games. The Baggies have been a side transformed in recent weeks, with Allardyce's men first putting in an excellent display against Manchester United. Then they followed that up by dominating Burnley on Saturday despite having Semi Ajayi sent off after just 30 minutes. He said they will have a chance of reeling in the likes of Newcastle, Brighton and Burnley if they continue to keep things tight at the back. The defensive side is getting better and better. We need to keep that nice and tight, Allardyce said. If we get 8 or 9 clean sheets from the next 13 games, we'll have a chance. What we have to do is keep applying ourselves as well as we have and be consistent in our performances and get a little better each game. Certainly, we have to get more clinical in front of goal. The sad thing is, since I've been here, we've only won 1 when we should have won at least 4 and the last 2. Next week becomes an even bigger task to try to go out and win because it's a need-to-win-now basis. A bizarre Ilan Meslier own goal saw Wolves make it 4 unbeaten in the Premier League with an encouraging 1-0 triumph over Leeds. Building on a sublime second half at Southampton, Nuno Espirito Santo's pack had a bit of luck on their side to come out on top at Molineux and make it back-to-back wins. Adama Traore's long-range fizzer smacked the crossbar and back off keeper Meslier before finding the back of the net. Wolves had Rui Patricio to thank for some top saves along the way as well, but they displayed both quality and a heartening work rate to complete the double over Marcelo Bielsa's men. There were a lot of positives for Nuno to take from this win, and supporters can go into the weekend with smiles on their faces. The willingness to press, get bodies up the pitch, and most importantly get shots off was much more like it from Wolves. So often this season they have been so reserved, but there was none of that against Leeds. The visitors have developed a reputation for taking risks and looking to play attractive, attacking football, and Wolves fought fire with fire. Lady Luck was on their side with the goal, but they earned that good fortune, as that Traoré attempt was not a one-off, far from it. It was one of many strikes from distance, and if you don't buy a ticket, well, you won't win the raffle. Patricio was on his mettle to keep the visitors at bay and claimed a well-deserved clean sheet, not only with his saves, but his calm claims from crosses which took the pressure off time after time. Seeing Fernando Marçal, who has been blighted by injuries throughout his time at Wolves so far, go off with yet another problem was a concern. But on the whole, Wolves, who now find themselves 11th in the table, can look back on this as a top night's work. They next face a struggling Newcastle side away at St James's Park this Saturday.
Thanks, Ian. And now, before we head over to Liz, we have a poem written by Ian about Wolves.
Last on match of the day. He had done bad old Nuno, eh? He's took Wolves up the table. He's took we to the Premier League. We'd aye think we was able. Seventh players twice on the trot. We'd been to Wembley too. He's took we to the dizzy heights where we'd aye used to go. But there's a problem that's hard to solve. The Wolves aye entertaining. They call win games attractively. It must be how them training. We'm last on match of the day. Don't matter who we play. Win or lose, how more away, we'm last on match of the day. How'd Nuno try to fix it, but it only made it worse. The only way that Wolves can win is when they park the bus. They don't get much possession, it can be very boring. The only tactic in every game to stop the others scoring. We'm last on match of the day, don't matter who we play. Win or lose, how more away, we'm last on match of the day. Nuno wants to entertain. He wants us to attack. But we are successful without five at the back. I hope our Nuno solves this Portuguese paradox. It would be nice to see gold shirts in the opposition box. We'm last on match of the day. Don't matter who we play. Win or lose, how more away. We'm last on match of the day. We love old Nuno, he's done so much, he's brought with great success. When he arrived from Portugal, the club was in a mess. Let's hope he puts it right again, so we don't hear Gary say, once again the Wanderers, I'm last on match of the day. We'm last on match of the day, don't matter who we play. Win or lose, home or away, we'm last on match of the day.
Cheers for that, Ian. We now head to Liz, who this week is taking a look at decimalisation.
It is exactly half a century ago this month in which we saw decimalisation reach Britain. 50 years ago, Britain finally made the switch to decimal currency, and the people of the West Midlands seemed decidedly unimpressed. Even the youngsters had their concerns. I'm trying hard, and I hope it's going to be all right, although I must confess I'm a bit worried, said 21-year-old Christina Thorpe from Shrewsbury. It's a bit of a nuisance, added 19-year-old shoe shop assistant Glenys Powell. Young mother Muriel Pritchard thought it would be used as an excuse to put up prices. I know that in Wolverhampton they have been putting on the odd penny and tuppence, she said. I'm trying to think in decimals, but I'm carrying my shoppers' tables with me to make sure I don't get diddled. People had good reason to be sceptical. Spending a penny was clearly going to be more expensive than before, and the decision by the region's two main brewers to put a penny on the price of a pint also left a bitter taste in the mouth. Granny Gets the Point, a short film where a grandmother stubbornly refuses to listen as her grandson tries to explain the new system, managed to patronise viewers in the way that only public information broadcasts can. And if that wasn't bad enough, Max Bygraves was commissioned to record an excruciating song called Decimalisation, which only served to demonstrate why governments and popular culture should never be allowed to mix. Still, 15-year-old Sandra Martin was more optimistic. "I think after a while everybody will get the hang of it," she said. And while some of the public relations was ham-fisted, people could hardly complain they hadn't been given fair warning. This was a change that had been brewing for nearly 150 years. And it was a man from this neck of the woods who started it. Sir John Wrottesley, who lived in Purton near Wolverhampton, first proposed the idea in 1824. Sir John, who was MP for Staffordshire, had been impressed by the simplicity of the French franc and thought a similar system could be introduced here. The Decimal Association was founded in 1841 to encourage the change, and the first tentative step came in 1849 with the introduction of the silver florin worth 24 old pennies, or 1/10 of a pound. The logical next step would be to divide the florin into 10 pennies, but it was going to take a while. Russia had been the first country in Europe to embrace decimal money in 1704, when Peter the Great introduced the silver ruble, equivalent to 100 copper kopecks, although the Chinese had been using a similar system for about 2,000 years. The United States followed suit in 1792, basing its currency loosely on the Spanish dollar, and the 19th century saw a number of countries across mainland Europe make the switch. Yet for some reason, the idea of decimalisation remains resolutely unpopular in Britain. In 1961, then Prime Minister Harold Macmillan set up a committee headed by respected academic Lord Holsbury to examine the different options. One option was to follow the Australian model, which had introduced a dollar valued at 10 old shillings, which would then be divided into 10 rather than 12 pence, meaning only a small change to the value of a penny. Wrottesley's pound and mill system, which would see the pound divided into 1,000 mills, would effectively replace the old farthing. Another was to create a new pound valued at 100 pennies. However, when Holsbury presented his report in 1963, he decided that the pound's value as a reserve currency on the international money markets was too important to tamper with. Instead, he opted for a system which effectively retained the pound, florin and shilling in their existing form, but revalued the penny so that there were now 100 pennies to a pound, 10p to a florin and 5p to a shilling. By this time, rising inflation meant copper coins were becoming less important, so revaluing the penny had less of an impact on the economy. Yet the decision to go decimal, which followed 140 years of agonising about its pros and cons, was actually made in seconds on the whim of a Prime Minister. By this time, the youthful Harold Wilson had been elected on a pledge to reshape Britain in the white heat of revolution, and the new PM was keen to be associated with anything modern and progressive. Economist Peter Jay, whose father-in-law, Jim Callaghan, was Chancellor of the Exchequer, recalls Callaghan briefly calling in next door to discuss the matter with the Prime Minister. They talked for about 20 seconds and Wilson said, "Well, why not?" And that is how the decision was made, he says. In a few seconds, a century and a half of argument about decimalisation came to an end. The decision was announced in Parliament in 1966, and it was decided that the system would be phased in over a number of years to give people time to adjust. The first decimal coins, the 5p and 10p, were introduced in April 1968. The Royal Mint deliberately ensured that the new coins were all but identical to the existing shilling and florin, only with the inscriptions 5 new pence and 10 new pence. They had exactly the same value as the old coins, and once the novelty wore off, they were pretty much treated as such, with shops still pricing their items in pounds, shillings and pence. But when the old 10-bob note was replaced by the 50p coin the following year, the reaction was much more hostile. The first seven-sided coin in the world, the change was too much for some people, with one newspaper headline describing it as a monstrous piece of metal. A retired colonel even launched an anti-heptagonist movement, but there was yet more to come. Dubbed D-Day by the media, February the 15th, 1971, saw the launch of the new 1p and 2p coins and the official switchover to decimal pricing. Many businesses had already launched a dual pricing system at the start of the year, where prices were marked in both old and new pence to get people used to the new system. This continued for some time, and old pennies remained in circulation for a further 18 months. To help deal with problems caused by rounding up prices, a new halfpenny coin was introduced on a temporary basis. Not to be confused with the old halfpenny, which had been dropped 2 years earlier, the tiny new coin effectively replaced the old penny. It would be a while before we saw the end of the old silver coins, though. The sixpence, valued at 2.5 new pence, remained in circulation until 1980, and the shilling and florin would last to see the 1990s. The florin, in fact, remained in use until 1993, some 22 years after D-Day, and 9 years after the unloved new halfpenny was withdrawn from circulation. Of course, by the early 1970s, coin-operated machines were becoming increasingly commonplace, and both public utilities and private companies faced the mammoth task of adapting thousands of phone boxes, vending machines, and parking meters. Many mourned the passing of the old coins. The commentator, Dominic Sandbrook, described D-Day as the day we lost a little bit of our national soul. But while new pence will never have the romance of the tanner or the half crown, even the most dyed-in-the-wool traditionalist would surely acknowledge that decimalisation has made life a lot easier.
Thanks for that, Liz. It's now time to find out how many questions you got right in our flashback quiz. So, Mina, do you have the answers all lined up for us?
I do. So here are your answers for this week's flashback quiz. Are you ready? Question 1. How long was the longest tiramisu that was made in Italy? And the answer is 897 feet and 3 inches. Question 2. How many took to the saddle to ride the longest bicycle? The answer is, well, Roger never actually said, so that was a bit of a trick question. Question 3. How many times would you have to fold a piece of paper so it would be thick enough to reach the moon? And the answer here is just 42 times. Question 4. In what year was Oxford University founded? And the answer, 1096. Question 5. What makes stars appear to twinkle? And the answer is the Earth's atmosphere. And finally, question 6. How heavy is an average cloud? And the answer here is 551 tons. How did you do? Did the trick question catch you out this week? Well, however you did, there's always another opportunity to have a go next week. Now, to end this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News, it's time as always to visit Graham Fisher to hear one of his tales from the barn.
Hello. The year of 2012 has already, quite literally, gone down in history, and its entry for the United Kingdom in the online dictionary Wikipedia celebrates, amongst other notables, the London Olympic Games, the Diamond Jubilee of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, and the victory of Andy Murray in the US Open, the first British male to win a Grand Slam event since Fred Perry in 1936. This was particularly fitting in so much that the last female Brit to triumph in a Grand Slam, Virginia Wade's memorable victory over Betty Stover at Wimbledon, also secured her place in history in a Jubilee year, Her Majesty's silver one of 1977. Gosh, was it that long ago? Anyway, back to my Wikipedia entry, and I noticed that Jamie Oliver's latest cookery masterpiece of the time, Jamie's 15-minute meals, hit the shelves in 2012. So I think I can justifiably lay a portion of blame on his shoulders for deflecting public attention from a humble tome of mine that was also published in that year, but from which I can at least take solace that, unlike Mr. Oliver's, mine was officially launched at the International Festival of Glass in Stourbridge. The significance of the festival will become apparent, but first I will enlarge on the book. No, this isn't a shameless plug to boost sales. In fact, I needn't even mention the title, but simply state that it was the official account of a remarkable project by a team of Stourbridge craftsmen and women, led by a lifelong glassman, Mr. Ian Jury, to recreate the Portland vase, one of the most enigmatic examples of Roman cameo glass the world has ever seen. 2,000 years old and of uncertain origins, this iconic piece currently resides in the British Museum and remains an example of glassmaking skills sans pareil. Inspired by a desire to dispel mischievous myths and show that the requisite skills were still extant in Stourbridge, Ian set about replicating the Portland vase together with various other artifacts from the period, and he very graciously invited me to record the event from start to finish. So there you have it. The book's publication led to the inevitable round of speaking engagements, and it is here that I noticed the continuance of a phenomenon that I had already been tackling for some time past. The number of people who believed the Stourbridge glass industry was, like the Monty Python parrot, dead, quite dead, ceased to be, expired, gone. Yet here was I, presenting details of a momentous undertaking, offering the clearest evidence to the contrary. Most curious. As long ago as the early 18th century, the satirist Jonathan Swift, he of Gulliver's Travels, observed that falsehood flies and the truth comes limping after it. Oh, how true. Once a story takes hold, it's the devil's own to uproot it. So, let me give this one my best shot. Admittedly, the Stourbridge industry can no longer supply thousands of items of glassware, as it once did for the likes of the White Star Line, owners of RMS Titanic. When luminaries of the day, including the Astors, Strausses and other wealthy passengers, enjoyed their last meal in the doomed vessel's lavish first-class dining room on Sunday the 14th of April 1912, exactly a century before London's latest Olympic year, it also hosted them in 1908 and 1948, they would have imbibed from some of the finest glass ever produced by Stuart Crystal. The respective date obscures an unfortunate coincidence. RMS Olympic was a sister ship to Titanic, but there the happenstance ends. The descent from such lofty attainments was a protracted and painful one that was reflected across the entire industry, with Stuart's being amongst the last of the major players to finally shut its doors in 2001. This did bring to a close what one might refer to as the heavyweight side of manufacturer, but the ensuing implication that glassmaking has not survived is far from accurate. There are still companies in Stourbridge and the surrounding area that produce glass from decorative to specialist, together with a number of skilled engravers and decorating outlets. But it's the studio glass movement that has transformed the concept of glassmaking both here and further afield. The movement is credited with starting in America and burgeoning in the 1960s before spreading to Europe and the UK, Australia and the Far East. Studio glassmakers use glass as a medium to produce decorative or functional sculptures, artwork and vessels, which are a statement on the part of their creator. The studio glass movement has transformed how glass is both used and perceived as a medium, and, as with any art form, has produced its maestros. In America, Dale Chihuly has become revered worldwide as a virtuoso. He's singled for reference here by dint of a piece of his having been acquired for the new White House Cohen Museum of Glass in Wordsley. The museum has been created on the site of the former Stuart Works by the British Glass Foundation, which was itself only constituted as recently as 2010. Closer to home, a trawl through the internet will reveal entire directories of Stourbridge glass artists who work in or have connections with the Stourbridge area. Development of the former Webb Corbett site by the Ruskin Mill Trust, the internationally recognised Red House Glass Cone, and the arrival of the White House Cone Museum of Glass offer a fresh opportunity, hitherto never possible, for these distinct elements of the industry to coalesce, not only to promote the glass industry, but as part of the inclusive strategy for business, tourism, heritage and leisure that brings together the constituents of this unique region in a cohesive interpretation. The Limestone Mines of Dudley, the Black Country Living Museum and the local canal system are just three examples of attractions that already draw visitors here in their hundreds of thousands every year and which are inextricably linked with the glass industry. The growing national appreciation of the importance of our heritage is also reflected locally in all manner of reserves, specially designated sites, areas of interest and heritage trails. Glassmakers, like the boaters of old, are characteristically diffident and not generally prone to personal braggadocio. Though, whilst perhaps reticent to flaunt the light glowing beneath their bushels, there should be no compunction in reminding others precisely where those bushels lie. As Dag Hammarskjöld, Swedish diplomat and second Secretary General of the United Nations, once observed, "Our duty, our reward, our destiny are here and now." Massive investment, a brand new museum, a burgeoning studio glass movement, a myriad retail and other outlets, all within the compass of a few square miles, and all the focus of a biennial celebration, the International Festival of Glass I mentioned earlier, during which believers come from across the globe to this small corner on the southwest fringe of the Black Country to celebrate their passion for glass. A moribund industry? It is difficult to envisage a higher concentration of glass activity in all its diversity in any other part of the world. And let us not forget those tendrils that continue to spread far and wide. One of these is in fact close to the barn in nearby Hay-on-Wye. There's a delightful little workshop and gallery whose proprietors trained at the former Briley Hill Glass Centre, later to become the International Glass Centre, a catalyst in the careers of numerous outstandingly talented exponents. The Stourbridge glass industry has suffered grievously, but has adapted and survived. And will, if the accruing evidence is to be our touchstone, continue to flourish on the world stage. And why not? When it's already rained fishes and then frogs, it's an ill-advised soothsayer who dares tell you that cats and dogs cannot possibly follow. Enjoy your Black Country, and do join me again soon for more Tales from the Barn.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!